So just a reminder that, like yesterday, today will be really held in a sort of background climate of silence. I know we do quite a lot of talking in here, and it's quite lovely to treasure the silent spaces. And also, if you haven't already done so or are not entirely convinced that you've done so, please double-check that you've turned off your phone. And, you know, if you can, to please leave it off for the day. I like a little neurosis around cell phones, please. You know, a little OCD here is a good thing, you know, check, double-check, triple-check. Good, great. We're finally sure we can rest. So I want to just recap a little bit from where we got to yesterday so that we're starting kind of all in the same page. So, you know, the Buddha was primarily concerned with one thing. You know, in fact, when he asked what his teaching was, he said, you know, I teach just one thing, that there is dukkha and there is the end of dukkha. Dukkha describing the whole tangled web of confusion that we can find ourselves in. And the Buddha never described, and the end of dukkha is, and certainly in this teaching, liberation. It's a liberation of the heart, it's a liberation of the mind, it's the end of the tangle, the end of the confusion. And the Buddha never described the liberation as a state, but as an understanding. You know, when he got up from the Bodhi tree, he didn't go around from then on and say, you know, guess what, I had this really neat experience, you know, and I really like to hold on to that. Instead, he got up from the Bodhi tree and actually talked about what he had understood and what he had seen. And actually, the heart of also what he taught was that what he had seen, anyone could see. This was an understanding available to all. So one of the ways, and there's many, many words that are used to describe that understanding, and bearing in mind this is an embodied understanding. You know, this is the Buddha's understanding or concern was that our understandings are embodied in our speech, our actions, our choices, our relationships, that they're not something about just, you know, something that we reserve for a particular space or time in our life. He says, if it's not embodied, what difference does it make? If we don't embody our insights, don't embody our understanding, really what difference does it make? And I also think it's useful to mention here, you know, that, you know, because a lot of you probably self-identify as in some way or other practicing insight meditation or, you know, being in the insight tradition. Some of you may not, but certainly I think it's very important to recognize that insights are something we practice. These are not something we get. These are understandings that we actually practice. And we spoke about this yesterday, this sense of cultivation. You know, this sense of bringing into being rather than just meditating. And actually in that process of cultivation, we are actually practicing insight. So one of the words that the Buddha used to describe liberation was this word Nirodha. You know, there's many words, Nibbana, Upekkha, actually, but one word is Nirodha in Pali. And Nirodha actually translates as ceasing to leak. Ceasing to leak, okay? So what are we ceasing to leak in? Or what is there a cessation of leakage? And it is what we are talking about yesterday with the anusiyas, the underlying tendencies that are born of the four distortions that we talked about yesterday. They are ceasing to leak into perceptions and ways of being. Okay. So I quite like this kind of metaphor of ceasing to leak, you know, because I think we're very aware of when we're leaking, aren't we? You're very aware of when you're leaking ill will or when we're leaking lust, you know, or when we're leaking doubt, because we see how that leakage really moves into our speech and our actions and our choices and, you know, our relationships. I mean, you get a sense of what it feels like to leak. It's an interesting one, isn't it? It's kind of like you can just almost feel this sort of tendency just kind of beginning to seep through, you know, into our ways of being present with ourselves and others. So the Buddha talks about ceasing to leak, and when there is a cessation of leakage, then of course perception is undistorted. We are able to see anew. We are able to approach the moment without the backlog of how we have experienced a moment before. We are able to approach another person without being colored by the memory bank of our likes and dislikes and conclusions. We are able to approach ourselves with a sense of curiosity and freshness and sense of capacity rather than the world of conclusions of who we are. Because I think what is quite important to understand, these underlying tendencies that we talked about yesterday, I mean, most people would recognize, you know, that they've got all of them in one form or another, you know, even though there might be specialties. You know, most people find they've got all of them one way or another. But what is important to understand is that these are self-builders. These are how we build a sense of self. You sense that? The I am-ness, you know, or the I need, or I don't want. These underlying tendencies are self-builders. These are how a sense of self is shaped and formed by these underlying tendencies. Now, it's also very critical in understanding that to see that self-building and world-building are mutually interwoven constructions. Okay? They're mutually interwoven constructions. So if the anusias, these underlying tendencies, are building a self, you know, I'm so aversive, you know, I really don't like this, I really can't bear this. We're building a world at the same time, aren't we? The world that we can't bear and the world that we don't want and the world that we don't like. You know, if craving is building a self of what I need and must have, you know, and must get and insist upon it, it's actually also building a world at the same time, isn't it, that seems to offer the possibility of answering that craving. So these are simultaneous arising. Remember, what we talked about yesterday is this process of constructing a world. You know, and the essence of this discourse was really placed in the context of asking the questions of, you know, how do we end conflict? How do we end the argument? How do we end this sense of struggle and alienation and division? And, you know, and it put dukkha in that context, you know, and so the Buddha was really concerned in this. How do we understand the nature of how that conflict and struggle and alienation is actually created and constructed? And how can it come to an end? How can it come to an end? You know, and I think when we look at our own experience, you know, in the places of where there's tangles and where there's conflicts and where there's alienation, we actually see how that is sustained by these underlying tendencies constantly being activated and reactivated, which builds my sense of self, and it also builds the sense of the other simultaneously. And, you know, for me, this is such a sort of relevant discourse for our times, you know, where we see, you know, that our world's so riven with conflict. And then we bring that down to even a more personal level of the conflicts or estrangements and the arguments that are present in our own lives, with ourselves, with others, with the world as it is. So the Buddha's really interested in this sense of self-building and world-building. Now, what you've probably become very apparent to you right now in your life is that when the anusyas are leaking, by the way, they're not always leaking. which is the good news, and it's really, really helpful to notice the moment when there is no leakage happening. In, you know, we're not consistently in that state of leakage. And, you know, we tend to focus so much on, you know, the times of difficulty and the times of struggle that we actually don't even often really value or really even notice the times when there is no leaking happening. But one of the signs that leaking is happening is the magnitude of the narrative. It's the magnitude and the volume of the self story, the narrative. And it's probably, if you look at it carefully, you would probably recognize that the anusyas, which are, you know, certainly in Buddhist psychology would be considered to be unwholesome tendencies, by the way, because they're unhelpful. You know, they don't help. They don't help ending the struggle, do they? So they're considered to be unwholesome because they lead to suffering and recreate suffering. But the strength of the narrative is entirely related to the strength of the leakage. Have you noticed that? Like if I'm a little bit aversive, I probably have a fairly, you know, minor narrative. If I'm really aversive, I have a really big narrative about myself or about the thing I'm aversive to or, you know, about the person I'm aversive to. You know, if I'm really in a state of, you know, a craving leakage, you know, you'll see the narrative building up, won't you? So it's, and you will notice actually in the presence of, you know, the wholesome. I once wanted to title this exploration as the anusyas of wisdom, but I got shot down by my Pali scholar friends because anusyas are always considered to be unwholesome. But you know, wisdom also has a certain manifestation, embodiment, doesn't it? I mean, kindness, generosity, patience, compassion, spaciousness. But you will notice in the presence of the wholesome, the narrative is very small. We don't get up in the morning and say, you know, why am I spacious? I shouldn't be kind. You know, I wonder why I'm kind today. You know, something must be wrong. I'm kind today. You know, we don't have that kind of narrative, do we, in the presence of the wholesome? So there's some really big clues around, you know, because I think it's really important to put this into a practice level, you know, an embodied level. And there tends to be some really big clues available to us around when leakage is happening. You know, one of them is somatic clues. You know, these tendencies have quite big somatic effects, you know. Check in with the body when it's in the process of leaking aversion or craving. You know? How does the body feel? You know? How is the body being shaped? You know? They tend to have really quite profound, actually. You know, some of these anusyas actually make us ill. I mean, not to overstate it, but they actually make us ill. You know, go around in a sort of, you know, repeatedly creating and leaking aversion. See what happens to the body. Not in good shape. It's tension, contractedness, stress. So there's some quite big clues for us to actually really begin to actually see and practice with these moments when we're actually moving into a state of argument or contention. And one of them is somatic experience, always available to us, you know, sensing how the body moves from a place of, you know, ease to contractedness. From ease to contractedness. One of the big clues of leakage is around the volume of the narrative. It's the volume of the narrative. Now, in this particular scheme that the Buddha was outlining in this, so what we covered yesterday is distorted views that we put the label of ignorance or confusion on, and we talked about the four distortions of views, that actually gets manifested in these tendencies, the mind inclining in a certain way because of the underlying views, that these tendencies in themselves distort perception, and this is where it becomes a very present moment experience, how I see, how I feel, how I think how I label, you know, how I conclude about the present moment, the definitions I bring, the judgments I bring. This is actually when the anusyas are leaking into perception and distorting perception. Now, when distorted perception is very prolific. So where we left off yesterday was about just beginning to approach this word papancha. The proliferation of thinking rooted in underlying tendencies and beliefs that distorts and colors our capacity to see things as they actually are. Now, this is a big practice clue. You know, when we see these thought storms happening that are carrying a particular emotional theme, you know, of wanting, not wanting, you know, aversion, doubt, you know, uncertainty, confusion, the narrative, the I story, then we know this is a big clue for us that actually that kind of narrative is really being fueled by distorted perception and the tendencies that are distorting perception. So this is a very available clue for us, isn't it? I mean, nobody is unfamiliar, I'm sure, with these kind of thought assaults, you know, where you feel so locked into a story that's going round and round and round. So convincing, isn't it? So magnetic in a way. I mean, papancha is a really, you know, generally if we look at it clearly, it's a pretty uncomfortable experience because it's very contracted. But at the same time, remember what we talked about yesterday, we can delight in the papancha. Remember what we talked about yesterday, when there is no longer seen here something to delight in, welcome, and hold on to, this will fade away. This will subside. But our narratives are very magnetic for us, you know. We can become so, delight is a kind of strange word to use for it, but entranced, I would say, is maybe a better word. You know, we can be entranced by our narratives, you know. Even though they're uncomfortable, this is sort of the perversity of it, even though they're uncomfortable, we're quite entranced by our story. And our stories. And yet, as long as we're entranced by the stories, this is kind of camouflaging what's going on underneath. So it's kind of distracting us from the curiosity of the investigation to see, well, what's actually fueling this? What is keeping this going? You know, these thought storms, these narratives, these stories that we're so engrossed in, they're sort of distracting because they do provide such a sort of level of magnetism that they tend then to push aside the questions that maybe would be helpful to ask. Like, what is actually keeping this going? Is this true? You know, it's a wonderful sort of Sufi teaching, you know, about, you know, kind of being mindful of thought storms and says, you know, ask a few questions, you know, is this helpful? You know, is this kind? Is it true? Well, try bringing those questions into some of those moments, you know, where we feel so contracted in the narrative. So papancha in the Buddhist... in this teaching, classically, it only has three forms. There's craving-based papancha, there's view-based papancha, and there's conceit-based papancha. You remember what I talked yesterday about the conceit of self. This is really the self story. Now, best not tell my best scholar friends this, but I've actually found this list inadequate because I actually, fear-based papancha is usually included under craving because craving is also aversion-based papancha, right? And my sense is the fear story has a different feeling to it than the craving and aversion story. I often feel it has a different kind of both somatic sense, but I often feel the content of fear-based papancha is often different than aversion-based papancha. Because it's often about strategizing, planning, rehearsing, you know, all of that kind of stuff about how to control. So to look a little bit about this, these different kind of papancha styles, papancha threads, craving-based papancha, the craving-based story, which is also the aversion-based story. Now, what's really involved in craving and aversion-based papancha? There's a whole lot of distorted view in that, isn't there? I mean, first of all, as we, you know, began to touch on yesterday, craving and aversion actually rests upon the belief that things, people, events, objects have the implicit power to please or displease us, to make us happy or to make us unhappy. This is the root, you know, the root of this distorted view that gives rise to this kind of papancha, this sort of proliferation. So think about craving-based papancha, what craving-based papancha, the craving story, feels like and looks like in your experience.
It grows in intensity over time.
Grows in intensity over time as long as you haven't achieved your goal. Yeah? And then once you achieve your goal, you wonder what it was all about. Or you've got a temporary moment, respite moment, you know, and then you kind of wonder, what was that all about? Yeah. It grows over time. It has a sense of compulsion to it, doesn't it? Craving-based papancha. I must have, you know, I need to get this, you know, I need to have this experience, I need to have this outcome. If you think about it in the Buddhist teaching, how, you know, craving is so often represented in that hungry ghost image, isn't it? The kind of, you know, the big belly and the tiny throat and mouth, you know, of prowling the world trying to satisfy an appetite that cannot be satisfied. So there's a certain, often a kind of, there can be even a quality of desperation in craving-based papancha. You know, my very life, my very survival, my very well-being comes to depend upon the achievement or the fulfillment of this particular craving. It's really the externalization of happiness, isn't it? And it's the externalization of unhappiness. What are some of the characteristics of aversion-based papancha? Because this is also under this tanha, craving-based papancha. What are the characteristics of aversion-based papancha? Because this is where we really, really find the argument, isn't it? It's really where we have the felt sense of the argument or the quarrel. Yeah.
Unwilling to accept what is.
Yep. Do you often find there's a kind of heat in aversion-based papancha? You know, it has a sort of fiery quality to sometimes, you know, when it's moving into really, you know, more extreme levels of rejection or denial or even hatred.
It seems to share what you talked about, craving as well. I mean, the sense that my very life depends on getting rid of this thing and avoiding it. It definitely puts externally my unhappiness is due to external causes, and it can become very compulsive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a sort of constriction, consolidating, solidifying of the view or the belief that's...
Yeah. Solidifying the distorted perception. You know, you really do make me unhappy, or this really does make has the power to make me really unhappy.
I find that there's a sticky quality to it as
well. Yeah.
Because the thing that we actually don't want, we're still like caught.
We're tied to it. We're hostage, made hostage to the world of events and experiences and objects through craving and aversion. We've kind of delivered our sort of sense of freedom into the hands of getting or getting rid of this. Yeah.
It creates division or separation, like other and self.
And I think that's a really important point, is the way that craving and aversion, because they're self-builders, they're simultaneously other builders. Mm-hmm. And the other is external, but the other can also be internal. You know, the illness we can't accept, you know, or the emotions or the self-views that we hate. So the other can also be, the quarrel can be an internalized quality between self and the other that we can't accept internally, the chronic pain or the illness or, you know, the sense of loss. But you notice how that self and other seems to grow in strength and grow in separation according to the intensity of the narrative. Both of these two, I mean, notice how craving and aversion based papancha are so repetitive, aren't they? I mean, the story hardly changes. You know, it's kind of like being sentenced to watch some horrible soap opera. You're like, over and over and over again. And yet still we're magnetized. You know, you think at some point we just get disenchanted and say, enough already. But actually, because it's a self-builder, this is really where the stickiness and the glue is. You know, it's about who I am and about who you are. So it's a self, it's self-builders. These are really, I often find these kind of like breakdowns of papancha really helpful because it turns them into real practice possibilities, you know, places where we practice insight. I know what's going on here. You know, we don't actually any feel that sense of helplessness or confusion that says, I have no idea what's going on here. You know, I think the great beauty of the Buddha's teaching and the clarity of it is to take this sense of bewilderment out of our life. Because when there's bewilderment, there's helplessness. You know? To take this bewilderment out, we can actually look at this process. And this is a process, by the way. This is a moment-to-moment process, trackable process that we can actually begin to trace. And we no longer say that, you know, how did I end up here? We know exactly how I ended up here. And actually we begin to find the ways to not end up here. But a lot of this is that first statement that we went to yesterday, when nothing here is found to delight in, welcome, or cling to, these patterns subside. You know, and that's, I think that's a very core piece of this. You know, how much we might be willing or reluctant to actually see a narrative as a narrative or a story as a story, and maybe not the actuality of what's going on. So the second of these papancha threads is view-based papancha or ditti-based papancha. Oh, we have a lot of opinions. So many views, you know, and quite, you know, and if you look at what a lot of quarrel is, isn't it the incompatibility of views? You know, it's my view bumping up against your view and they don't actually agree. Isn't this a lot of the quarrel in our lives? You know, is this kind of conflict or clash of views? But remember that the anusyas are self-builders. So our sense of who we are is actually very, very closely interwoven with our views, isn't it? About the world, you know, political views, social views, you know, world views, big views, little views, you know. They're kind of prolific, aren't they? And we actually don't, it's about, you know, it's not the expectation suddenly that there's not going to be any views arising, because they really arise really quickly. But how lightly do we hold them? Or again, how much are these things we delight in, invest in, and cling to? Because when we don't have that propensity to delight in, invest in, and cling to, we begin to see a view as a view, as something that is, you know what? Our views we come to see are the only thing at all that keeps things fixed in place. And isn't this part of our argument? We actually, part of us wants the certainty of things being fixed in place. You know, my view of you is the only thing that keeps you fixed in place as being a certain kind of person, rather than a dynamic, unfolding, fluid process. So views are often this kind of quest, isn't it? Some sort of a kind of underneath quest for stability, control, certainty, the ability to say, I know. You know? I know you. Or I know how the world is, you know. I know who I am. So I think this whole domain of views is just so such a critical part for us to understand, because, you know, how often views are created through seizing upon a fragment of experience and mistaking that fragment to be the whole. You remember Sam yesterday, my mythical Sam. By the way, he is a mythical Sam. Yeah. Sam, the uncooperative yogi, you know. Well, you know, as long as I seize upon that fragment of Sam and form a view about it, I never see the whole of Sam, do I? I only see the part of Sam that actually irritated me or stimulated one of those underlying tendencies. But Sam is frozen forever in that fragment. Because, you know, it's quite, doesn't it feel a little bit risky to actually, to be able to risk saying, I don't know, or I don't know you. And I don't think we have to, you know, if you look at some of the campaigns and things that are going on right now.
Oh, like what?
Not to name any in particular. But my goodness, don't you just get overwhelmed by Ditti Papancha? You know, Ditti Papancha, you know, this view against that view about how, you know, our world is, how our society is, how people are. You know, it's extraordinary, isn't it, when it gets actually, you see it enacted on stage. But then we're kind of, we might find ourselves enacting it, our own little stages going on quite a bit, you know. So I think this is really a domain of narrative. If we really want to understand the quarrel and to end the quarrel. Because when there's an attachment to view, there's. Remember when we said yesterday, you know, when there's a practice of this, there's the abandonment of that. You know, when there's a practice of greed, there's the abandonment of generosity. You know, when there's a practice of aversion, there's the abandonment of metta. You know, I think when there's a practice of views, there's the abandonment of spaciousness. There's the abandonment of curiosity. You know. The abandonment of the real willingness and interest in actually being informed. We're so busy informing the world of experience through our views that actually there's not the curiosity to allow ourselves to be informed in a new way. You know, maybe Sam's not, it's a little bit more than that fragment that I described. So the third of these papancha threads, if you haven't got enough already, is this conceit of self thread. And remember how we talked about this yesterday, this kind of, you know, mana papancha, the story of me. The story of me. And, you know, when the Buddha presents how self, a sense of self is constructed, he presents it in two ways. One way is Sakaya Ditti, or personality view, okay? This is more evident to us. This is somewhat fluid, you know? I'm sad, I'm happy, you know, I'm generous, I'm extroverted, I'm introverted, you know, I'm excited, I'm calm. So personality view tends to be a little bit more malleable, you know, it's actually shaped by whatever is clung to in the moment, you know. And then, it, you know, it's like why we have, you know, 1,000 selves in a different day, you know, constantly forming this Sakaya Ditti or this personality view. This conceit of self, this self view, is far more, tends to be far more hidden, but far more toxic. You know, and if you really were interested in the sort of schemata of awakening, mana, this conceit of self, is actually one of the last tendencies to really disappear. Because it's often so hidden from view, it's often so entrenched, you know, of being inferior to you or superior to you as the same as you. It's often so entrenched, but it does inform personality view. You know, if I really feel inferior to you or lesser or not good enough, you know, I'm going to be prone to constantly form these views of who I am as being a failure or hopeless or despairing. You know? Because this is a self-narrative. This is a, one particularly, we might say, that we welcome, delight in, and cling to. And actually, you know, as long as this one is welcome, delighted, and cling to, probably going to welcome, delight, and cling to all the rest. You know, because all of the other papunchas, in a way, are in the service of the self-narrative, aren't they? Preserving or supporting or building the self-narrative. It's not difficult to spot this one, you know. Let's be honest here. You know, it's not like this is something we don't know or unfamiliar territory. My goodness, how much time do we actually spend in our thinking in the self-narrative? In what I need, what I have, who I am, what I want to get rid of, what I want to become, you know, what I don't want to become, you know. If we actually, you know, somebody actually sort of had the willingness to sit up here and just narrate their way through a single sitting period, you know, it's really unlikely that you would open your eyes and see a, you know, a group of people looking at you in shock and horror. You know, you'd probably like open your eyes and see people going, I am, I want, I need, you know, the I am builder, the I am story. The interesting thing about practicing insight is that we don't have to sort of go really looking very far. You know, it's kind of at hand. We sort of have everything we need, really, in any given moment for practicing stopping leaking, don't we? It's right there, the self-narrative. Now, that's a big entrancement. Even when it's difficult, it's a big entrancement. And it actually can subvert the whole meditative process, I want to say that, the self-narrative. It actually can hijack the whole meditative process, can be co-opted into the desire for becoming and the desire for non-becoming. When our practice becomes a process of what I'm working on or improving or getting rid of, in obvious and really subtle ways, this particular tendency and its narrative can hijack the entire meditative process that comes to be a process actually of improving myself or working on what I don't want or, you know, working on getting rid of things. I think we need to be so, so careful of this because this can be so subtle that, you know, instead of actually practicing in a way of cultivating, bringing into being that which liberates, that which is healing, that which is freeing, we're going to the coal face and we're working. It's really a big question. You know, we don't actually really understand always how our self-view is implicated in the very things that we're working on. Can you see that? I'm working on my issues. My issues are actually creating the sense of self. Who needs then to work on the issues that has created the sense of self? If that makes any sense at all to you, that that's actually going to be a pathway of freedom, I'd really like to hear that information. this is such a crucial piece, I think, in terms of how we approach our practice. I mean, certainly Western culture is the only culture I know of that would use work and practice interchangeably. As many rope ladders. I think it's a complete change in orientation. If you read the early texts, there's very little indication that this is a process of working on issues or working on things. If you look at the early texts, this is a process of cultivating the wholesome and the lovely and the liberating.
Isn't that working on things?
Cultivation, no, we're growing. We're not concerned with our fascination is not with the problematic. Our concern is what is possible in this moment. With what is possible. What is possible to cultivate. How much generosity, how much patience, how much kindness, how much calm, how much spaciousness, how much collectedness can be cultivated in this moment. This is a dedication. This is not looking at what's in the way of that. It's actually saying, oh, this is actually where I'm located. My capacity is in this sense of cultivation. This is very hard to convince Western students of. We come from a therapeutic background, which is very wonderful and helpful. We come from a background of, and I'm not saying this in at all in a judgmental way, by the way. We come from a culture of self-centeredness, self-concern, And it's not just that we cultivate that inwardly. This is actually a message given to us constantly by the environment in which we live. So it's a really reinforced feedback loop, Who you become, who you are not becoming. It's a very different orientation, and I think it's actually so important to see in the practice is this path of bhavana, of what is being, this is where I talked about practicing insight. We practice calm, we practice generosity. Where do we practice it? Well, in the midst of all these anusyas, not after they've gone away. In the midst, this is our classroom. This was the genius of the Buddha. It was not about transcending the world or transcending the body or transcending the mind. He was concerned with actually transcending suffering through understanding and through practicing insight in the midst of these tendencies. These are not obstacles to awakening. These are classrooms of awakening. And it's in those classrooms that actually the Buddha, this is why he talked about listening to the teaching being so important. It's in the midst of that classroom that we actually cultivate that, which is lovely, which is not implicated in the anusyas. Remember, go back to that line yesterday, when we are practicing aversion, we have abandoned metta. When we are practicing craving, we have abandoned generosity. So in a sense, what it's really being pointed to, reclaim that which has been abandoned and cultivate it in the midst of the anusyas. They are not after they go away. It's such a huge reorientation in the practice. And I must say, this is an uphill task, because it's not just our cultural social conditioning that actually leads us to these kind of ideologies of what I'm working on. It's hardwired, every bit of neuroscience research, just reveals how the mind preferences the imperfect. It takes us much more energy to actually remember that which is lovely than to remember that which is difficult. And it's one of the distortions that actually feeds into perception. The brain is much more hardwired to walk out the door and actually notice what is wrong than to notice what is lovely. So it takes a little bit of effort, as I said yesterday, it takes a little bit more effort to actually cultivate that which is healing and wholesome than to practice that which is unhelpful. But this is about changing how the mind is shaped. It's about coming out of the quarrel, changing how the mind is shaped. So there's 1,000 rope ladders every moment. It's choosing how you pay attention and the quality of your attention and where you place it. Because again, this whole line about welcoming and am I repeating? Am I boring you? No. Okay. Remembering that gift of mindfulness is offering that moment of choice of where we place our attention, the quality of our attention, and what we attend to in any given moment. So we cultivate the mindfulness that offers that choice, because that choice is a little moment of freedom of stepping out of these repetitive cycles.
Are people in other cultures, do they have brains that are wired differently?
No. But they have less of the cultural messages that say, you know, this is actually your fault. They have less of those cultural messages of blame and shame. But ego's not, I mean, ego's a very Western psychological term,
right.
You know, and you know, Buddhist psychology doesn't really entertain that term. Buddhist psychology is much more process-centered, you know, rather than ego. We actually have a process where a sense of self is being created and recreated through what is contracted around or clung to. But of course, when there's been a pattern of contracting around and clinging to the same things over and over again, you know, like a particular anusya, we build up a self-structure that's probably more related to what you're using the word ego to describe, the I am-ness, that feels more constant. But from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, it's only more constant because there's been a particular process that's been repeatedly spun. So it becomes more, it seems to gain a certain truthfulness. Yeah. So, you know, Buddhist psychology is not dealing with this level of, you know, ego and superego and unconscious. Actually really concerned with the process of the moment of self-building and self-dissolving. And that's not about annihilating the self. It's about taking away the clinging, the welcoming, the delighting in factor, which is what freezes things.
So when you do that and you strip it and then you have enlightenment, is that the absolute truth?
It doesn't use those terms either. Absolute truth is not a Buddhist term.
It isn't.
No.
Okay.
No. Liberation is liberation from ignorance. It is an understanding. It's an applied, embodied, naturalized, internalized understanding in which the argument comes to an end and the leakages come to an end, and actually the mind is a friend. You know, and the world is seen as it is. You know, life is seen as it is. It allows, you know, it's not in liberation from, it's liberation to, as the Buddha put it. You know, it's not only liberation from the argument and from the conflict and the confusion, it's the liberation to respond with actually that term I'm not allowed to use, which is the anusias of understanding, you know, the responses of compassion, of generosity, of kindness, of clarity, of insight, of not living in a sort of fixed way. Not living in a fixed way.
When you were saying that in the suttas, or that the Buddha doesn't talk about this as work, or that we're not supposed to, and but he certainly talks about it in terms of effort. Which
absolutely.
We sometimes play. And when he talks about like the four right efforts, that's not only cultivating the good, but it's also
avoiding. It's avoiding the unhelpful, not delighting in, not welcoming, not clinging. The effort to do that. But it's, you know, remember you said talked about the sort of very medical model that the Buddha uses. You know, first he actually makes a diagnosis. You know, what is the problem? He looks at what is the cause of the problem. Well, we're talking about the cause of the problem, he says. Where is the end of the problem? The cultivation of right view, of right effort, of right action, you know, of right understanding. But that's what's cultivated. He doesn't say, you know, we're cultivating, you know, an improved self.
Right.
underlying tendencies and just kind of putting myself when I'm in a tangle and getting myself, and then thinking about what it feels like in my body and the heaviness and going lower and lower, and it's just, then I'm kind of stuck. But I also know how good it feels to not be in the tangle.
Absolutely.
So I just find it's either do a sit, go for a walk, do metta practice, prayers, to shift the dynamic. And the tendency will come back again. Like even the same problem or the same tendency may come back again, but it seems to be a temporary solution. But you talked about things being temporary. It's not the tendency is there, and the feeling, I don't know what the other part was, the day by day where we don't appreciate the flower or the nature or something like that. So there's kind of a, we're trying to build on this one.
Okay, so the question is, yes, the tangle is there, the tendency is to reappear. A lot of this is about, this is very key line of not delighting in, not welcoming, not clinging to. The tendencies start to lose their credibility in how they appear. The great genius of the Buddha, in my understanding, is that his teaching of liberation consistently builds upon what we already know, what we have already glimpsed. You know, when he talks about the power of metta, he's building upon something that we have already glimpsed or know. You know, when he talks about spaciousness or non-clinging, he's talking about something we have already glimpsed or already know. It's not a kind of import of some sort of abstract. We know moments of non-clinging. We actually know moments of non-selfing, many of them. Many more than we actually appreciate. Anybody brush their teeth this morning without being the brusher? Well, we laugh, but look at it. We have many, many moments in a day of non-selfing, because selfing and self-building and world-building is a process that appears and fades away. Now, because often there is so much painfulness involved in that appearance, we actually don't always notice the moments of fading away. There are many moments of non-self in a day. Now, we want to take those moments, which are often glimpsed as kind of little gaps or sighs of relief in between moments of selfing. We want to take those moments of non-selfing and turn them into understandings, not just as moments of relief, but to turn them into understandings. What is not happening in those moments is this process of constructing. What is present in those moments is the felt sense of non-constructing. So we need to take that felt sense and turn it into an understanding that we can actually practice and apply and embody. Only if they never gain any language. Language is obviously implicated in perception, isn't it? We inherit language, we create language. Language is not neutral. Our languaging is so interwoven with perception. It's part of perception, isn't it? Is language. We know something as we've known it before. I don't think we can, I've had children, I have, a very small grandchild in my life. I know he's absolutely not craving and aversion free. The question of why it's there doesn't concern me. The question of what it really concerns us is how that can be responded to. This is all about understanding ourselves. It's not about understanding somebody else. It's about understanding ourselves. Yeah.
from a real-world example of what happens, because I'm a bit confused by what is meant by working on or not working on. So if a hindrance comes, can you walk me through the...
Okay, well, a real-world example, I remember teaching a retreat recently where someone said to me it's the first time in 20 years that they haven't, that they've come to a retreat without an issue to work on.
So
what are they going to do if they're working on that issue? You know, a family tangle, a personal belief tangle. What are they going to do if they're working on that tangle? What would you do if you were working on a tango?
I would think a lot about it.
We would delight in it. We would welcome it. We would.
But I guess I'm thinking about what you're saying. So if a hindrance shows up in my mind,
like say aversion. You don't go into the content of it. You don't concern yourself with the narrative of it. You might concern yourself with actually knowing it. Oh, this is how aversion feels. Isn't that interesting? You don't conserve it. If you get into the papancha of it, you're lost. Because you're going to be stuck and welcoming and delighting and contracting. You certainly acknowledge it. You would certainly, aversion. You know, here is this particular nurse you come to visit. Oh, let me see what this feels like right now, you know. Let me see what it feels like right now, particularly somatically. Then I would say, in the midst of this, what is possible to cultivate? Can I befriend the aversion? Can I bring a sense of generosity and kindness to the aversion? So I'm not pretending it's not there, but it's actually what I'm cultivating in the midst of it. You're creating a dialogue, certainly creating a dialogue, a relationship with that aversion, rather than that what we usually do is either to go into the story of the aversion or to actually meet the aversion with a reenactment of that underlying tendency of aversion for aversion and saying, this shouldn't be here. So this shouldn't be here. How am I going to get rid of it? You know? Okay, and then instead we say, this is what aversion feels like. Oh, yeah, I know this place. How does the body of aversion feel? You know, how does the mind of aversion feel? How does the perception of aversion look like? Yeah? How is that aversion actually shaping perception in that moment? Okay, I know this. Now in the midst of this, what is it to cultivate a sense of spaciousness, of befriending, of calm, of creating space around the aversion rather than working on the aversion? It's very different. Okay, I just want to do this last little bit of papancha, if you don't mind. Then we're going to have a walking period that will come back. I'm sure you've been actually sitting. I'm spending way more time on this than I thought we were going to, but it's kind of curious. I don't really have a time frame. So this last bit of papancha, this is another one of these threads that's really helpful to recognize because, I mean, I think, in Buddhist psychology, aversion is rooted in fear, the fear of injury, you know. The fear of being hurt, the fear of loss, the fear of being out of control. But fear-based papancha often then has a very different kind of strategic response, doesn't it, to all of that. It wants to control, it wants to strategize. It's the big story, you know, of how I'm going to plan my way out of anxiety. You know, I'm going to rehearse my way out of anxiety, you know. I'm going to strategize, sort of guarantee the next moment in a certain way. And I'm sure, you know, many of you can recognize this particular thread of papancha. It's a very entrancing story, isn't it? Because we actually feel that we can think our way out of fear, you know, or we can think our way out of anxiety-provoking situations. It's a very compelling one in terms of to delight in, you know. And there's many, many situations in life, of course, which will trigger this baya papancha, you know. Aging is one of them. I mean, we have a whole consumer industry that's built upon fear, isn't it? strategizing our way out of it. It's one that's very, very important, actually, to take care of, because it's one of the biggest arguments we have with impermanence is fear-based papancha. This is one of the biggest quarrels we find ourselves in with the way things are, you know, in terms of change, is that we react to it with fear-based narrative. It's our quarrel, you know, our quarrels are not just with other people, our quarrels we are with, you know, the actualities of change, of unsatisfactoriness, and of non-self. These are our biggest quarrels. So I think this is probably a good time to have a half-hour walking period. I'm sure you must be ready for that. And then we'll move on with this whole material.